Tēnā koutou katoa and hello everybody. Welcome to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. My name is Ben Adelberg and I'm coming to you from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland.
And g'day, I'm Emma Strutt and I'm currently coming to you from Gungaloo Country in Queensland. And before we dive into our conversation today, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community.
The Lentil Intervention is an Australasian educational and advocacy platform dedicated to raising awareness about the current climate and health crisis.
And on this podcast, we invite guests to chat about topics that will inspire you to take action to improve your own health and the health of the planet.
So please subscribe to and share this podcast and visit our website for the full show notes.
And don't forget to buy us a coffee if you'd like to support our work.
We're very excited for this interview. In fact, we're always excited. But when it comes to guests linked to a Drift Lab, whether they're the PhD students that work in the lab or anyone that Jen Labers recommends, we know it's going to be a good one. We're talking science, but also in a way that we'll understand and we can learn. Also tying in with today's conversation is what seems to be quite a hot topic at the moment, and that is anything to do with carbon, carbon capture, carbon sequestration. The list can go on. So timely conversation. Emma, who's our guest?
Yeah, so today we're talking with Dr. Leonard Bach, who is an ARC Future Fellow for Climate Intervention at the Institute of Marine and Antarctic Studies at the University of Tasmania. Leonard is a marine biogeochemist and spends his time investigating consequences of and solutions for the climate crisis. So lots of interesting stuff to talk about today. Leonard, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. Thanks for inviting me.
I feel like I've just sat down for a lecture that I'm going to learn a lot. So before we crack in, Leonard, tell us a little bit about your background. Obviously, telling by your accent, you're not Australian, but you're living in Tasmania. So tell us a little bit about your journey into becoming a marine biochemist, what that means, and how you ended up in Tasmania.
All right. Yeah, so that's a bit of a... I'll try to make it short. So yes, I'm German and was born in southern Germany, so landlocked pretty much. But went in, you know, summer holidays with the parents to France and stuff like that. Really enjoyed the surfing, so that was my connection point. And then I thought, okay, how can I conserve this and, you know, try to be at the sea all the time? And then, marine sciences was the thing. I was interested in sciences, so I thought, yeah, marine sciences, that's it. So I studied in Kiel, that's in northern Germany, near Hamburg, at the Baltic Sea. Studied there for a long time, did my PhD there, and quite a long postdoc as well. And then at some point, you know, in academia, you have to do some changes every now and then to kind of refresh your way of thinking. And so it's a couple of, well, places in the world that are interesting, and Tasmania's was certainly one of them. So, yeah, that was a relatively easy decision also because Tasmania is obviously beautiful. And so moved here, did a postdoc first with Phil Boyd on ocean iron fertilization. So that's another climate intervention approach. And then was appointed as a senior lecturer in for phytoplankton research or phytoplankton lecturing and research. And then shortly after, I got a future fellowship, luckily, that gave me a lot of room for science or active research again. So that's where I'm at now. And the title you mentioned, this ARC Future Fellow for Climate Intervention, there's a bit of a fun story behind that because I thought, okay, what sounds funny in the internal financial system? And so I suggested that because I thought it sounds badass. And just to, you know, and now it's it, and all of a sudden the sign appeared on my door and I was a bit embarrassed. I was like, oh, that sounds a bit too much, so I kind of stepped away again from this, but for some reason it's stuck. Yeah, but anyways,
yeah, you've spoken about refreshing your mind and you know, going to cool places. Looking at your website, there's a section where you've got your impressions videos, and Wow, you've been to places like Greenland, Iceland, Peru. Tell us a little bit about those opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm in the wider sense, I'm a marine geochemist. So you introduced me as a marine biochemist, but the geo is very important here because biochemist is more someone who's dealing with proteins, you know, and small molecules for pharmaceuticals and this kind of stuff. And the biogeochemist would be someone who's dealing with global, well, elemental cycles, carbon, phosphorus, nitrogen, and this kind of stuff. So, and then obviously, because these cycles are worldwide, kind of, you know, global, then you also have to go to places where there's hotspots for certain, fluxes or processes in the Earth system. And with respect to climate change, these are hotspots I visited within my capacity as a postdoc and the research I was doing.
So, Leonard, we've used the word carbon on our show a lot in the past, and I think we've typically assumed a certain level of understanding with our listeners, but no one's ever really given us the basic 101. So in the context of climate change, what is carbon? What are we talking about here?
Well, carbon is the key element, or one of the key elements of life, obviously. So we are products of carbon, more or less, or all of the molecules that compose our biological systems are carbon based. And with respect to the climate, the obvious link is carbon dioxide. So the most oxidized version of carbon that happens to be a molecule that has a very long lifetime in the atmosphere, meaning it stays there for a long time once it got in there. And it also happens to be the geometry of the molecule is as such that it is excited by infrared radiation. So it starts to swing when it's excited, and therefore it retains energy and emits this energy again as heat, essentially, right? So so that's why it's quite an important element from various aspects.
So when carbon gets emitted, though, it doesn't just hang out in the atmosphere. There's that global carbon cycle that you mentioned, so it's going in and out of the biosphere. But obviously the uptake of carbon by our oceans is pretty significant, and that can lead to chemical changes. And this is kind of your area of expertise here. So talk us through that marine carbon cycle and what that actually means for our oceans and for what lives in them.
Yeah, so if we speak about the marine carbon cycle, we should first distinguish between the inorganic carbon cycle and the organic carbon cycle. So the organic carbon cycle would be everything that involves biology, you know, for example, the buildup of biomass through photosynthesis, and then various organisms eating plants and building secondary biomass and these things. And there's a cycle because carbon flows through the different components of a marine food web. And then there's the inorganic carbon cycle, which is, mostly, chemical. So, for example, when we start at the atmosphere with CO2, then the CO2 can go into the ocean. And CO2 is special because it's one of the few gases that when they dissolve in seawater, they also react with water molecules. So this is different to, for example, oxygen, which just stays as an oxygen molecule, O2, but CO2 reacts with water, H2O, to form carbonic acid. And this carbonic acid, you know it from sparkling water, right? So if you pump CO2 into your water, you get sparkling water. And that's essentially what also happens in the ocean. So you form carbonic acid, and this carbonic acid then partially dissociates and releases protons. And this is what we measure. The release of protons is what we measure as a decline in pH and what we call ocean acidification. So this is the basic chemistry behind ocean acidification. So it's linked to the atmospheric increase of CO2 through some chemical reaction in water.
So I guess looking at it from a different perspective for clarity, we talk a lot about, you know, on land, the importance of trees capturing CO2, the fact that it's stored in the soil. we're also now starting to get more exposure to the importance of the oceans and their ability to store carbon as well. But sounds like a silly question, but I'll ask it, and I'm sure a lot of listeners are thinking, thank you for asking this question. But from what you've just described, is there a point of there's too, the oceans are absorbing or can absorb too much carbon dioxide, too much CO2? That, you know, because you talk about that whole chemical reaction that leads to the acidification. Can, is this a thing, is it's capturing too much or storing too much?
Well, this is a question of perspective. So some organisms would not like a pH decline that is associated with the absorption of CO2, whereas other organisms would not think that is a problem or perhaps even benefit from this change. So there's this really depends on who you ask, basically. But in, like physically or chemically, the potential to take up CO2 is very high, much higher than we ever gonna push it through anthropogenic climate change.
Okay, so you don't think it's possible that we'll ever reach, you know, kind of like a tipping point at some stage and we'll flip from a like a negative feedback loop to positive? Like we're just too far off that?
Well, so tipping points, you mean in terms of biology, so that some biological components start to decay and induce feedback loops? Yeah, well, that is an option. I mean, that is a possibility that could happen, that the changes in the inorganic chemistry induce changes in biology that lead to climate feedbacks of various kind, could be positive or negative. There's multiple feedbacks that we can think of. But chemically speaking, there's no like, obviously there is a limit at some point, but not anything that would be relevant for the Earth system at this point. So we can just, the ocean will keep on absorbing CO2 no matter how much CO2 we pump into the atmosphere. Whether biology likes it or not is a different question. But the ocean just physically can take up a lot more.
So some things are going to benefit, but then others, for example, the Great Barrier Reef, the coral, that might be a different outcome there.
Yeah, those organisms will most likely be among the first to suffer, or if they're not already suffering a lot. It's a bit hard to, you know, in the real world to dissect impacts of climate change and, you know, account them to ocean acidification or warming. There's different, well, symptoms. And I wouldn't really know a study that clearly showed it's one or the other. It's most likely warming, in my opinion, but I'm not very greatly informed on this topic. But yes, certainly the Great Barrier Reef is at high risk due to that.
And just before we move on, in terms of setting the foundations here, you've spoken about what ocean acidification is. Can you explain to us briefly what calcification is? So ocean calcification, what does that mean?
Well, calcification is a biological process that many, many organisms do. So it's basically the formation of calcium carbonate. So for example, all sorts of snails or mussels, they just build their shells through a process we call calcification. And that is just the precipitation of calcium carbonate. So they use a calcium ion in seawater and a carbonate ion in seawater and combine them to calcium carbonate. That's what we call calcification.
And in your work previously, you've focused on plankton ecology. So firstly, you mentioned the food web before, so maybe set this up by just letting us know why plankton is so important to the ocean's food web. And then also, how does plankton respond to this rising level of ocean CO2? Is there any changes there?
Yeah, so, okay. Well, plankton are the smallest organisms in the ocean, generally speaking, but not necessarily. Plankton is defined as everything that drifts with the current. So a jellyfish would be plankton because it drifts with the current, right? Anything that can swim against currents is nekton, so that's fish and whales and these kinds of things. But so I was focusing on plankton so far, mostly. And well, plankton is important because phytoplankton, so the plankton that is doing photosynthesis, sets the basis of the marine food web. So phytoplankton in the global oceans produce roughly as much, so their primary production, the amount of carbon fixation per year, is roughly the same as all plants on land, right? So this is, it's the same scale. And so they set the scene for any organism in the ocean to gain their energy ultimately from, right? So the phytoplankton gets eaten by zooplankton, so by animals, small animals, and those animals get eaten by larger animals and so on. And because the interactions, so who eats whom, are very complicated. It's not like a food chain where it goes only one direction, but it can go multiple directions, and that's why we call it a food web rather than in the early days we called it a food chain, and now with increasing knowledge we call it a food web. And your second question,
Just how plankton's actually responding or changing to that rising level of ocean CO2.
Yes, all right, yeah. Well, again, a perspective question. So there will be winners and losers. One loser may be like plankton that calcifies. For example, small swimming snails called pteropods. They are important whale food. And because the chemical changes imposed by ocean acidification is, impeding calcification to some extent, they have a harder time building their shells, and therefore they grow less well. And they are potential losers under these changes. But there's also winners. So some phytoplankton, just because they have more carbon dioxide around them, they like that. So they photosynthesize better. So it's quite complex. So it is not like everyone's losing. It's more like there's some winners and losers. And the question for us from the human perspective is whether these changes are beneficial or not beneficial for us. I mean, we can cope quite well with the status quo, but the risk is that the changes that may come are not very good. But there's also changes that may be beneficial.
Yeah. And, your name's attached to a vast number of publications, which is, there's just far too many to look at. There's a couple that stood out for me. And just on this conversation, there's a paper here that I believe you led, stand to be corrected, but I think it's a 2016 paper titled Influence of Ocean Acidification on a Natural Winter to Summer Plankton Succession. First insights from a long-term mesocosm study draw attention to periods of low nutrient concentrations. And in there, you talk a lot about the restructuring of the marine ecosystem because of those changes. So, you say there's some winners and there's some losers, but that's affecting the food web as such, because if there's more of a certain food for a higher, sort of a predator, you'll see more of that. But similarly, you could also see less of certain species because there's less of their food, I guess. So there's certainly that impact being felt already. Is that the feeling? And is it becoming a problem, or is it just a rebalancing?
Well, yes, you summed it quite nicely. So there's the potential for restructuring, right?
Mm.
And the problem with plankton food webs is because of there's so many species floating around there, right? And everyone has their preferred food, and everyone is kind of within their ecological niche. And then some changes come enforced through the outside. In this case, and in the paper you referenced to, it was ocean acidification, which was simulated in an experimental setup. And then we'll observe changes. We'll observe a restructuring. So some organisms do better, some do worse. And then again, it's a perspective dependent interpretation whether the outcome is good or bad. If you ask the guy who's the loser, he's certainly not happy, right? If you look at humans usually, when you ask, when I'm asked, they're usually interested in, okay, what's the outcome for fisheries, for example. This is a human interest. Then you can give a clear answer, more or less clear answer, but you can say, okay, this change in the composure of the food web was beneficial for some economically important fish, right? But yeah, so that's why it's so incredibly hard to give a judgment on whether a change is good or bad, because it really depends on the perspective. I think, so my take home from years of doing these research studies was really, we won't really know whether it's beneficial for us or not, apart from some examples like the Great Barrier Reef is a good example where the outcome, like, you know, where it's easy to interpret for us that the changes are bad, right? But with plankton, it's so complicated because there's so many different communities and species around that the outcome is hard to predict, even though we did so many studies. So I always say there's a risk of change and there's the risk that this is negative. And do we want to take that risk? That is the question I'm always asking. And because I think the oceans were pretty healthy before they got perturbed, I personally wouldn't take the risk. I would recommend, let's not try this out. Let's try to reduce emissions and, you know, try to reduce our ecological and our environmental footprint to conserve the status quo. Because humanity thrived under the status quo.
And that kind of segues us into our next talking point, I suppose. I think it's fair to say that if we're to limit warming to 1.5 degrees and potentially even 2 degrees, it's going to be really unlikely to do that without substantially stronger climate action this decade. And the latest IPCC report actually highlighted that the use of carbon dioxide removal is basically going to be unavoidable if we want to reach net zero. Now, I know here in Australia, carbon capture and storage has been touted as either, you know, the technology that's going to save us or something that's way too expensive and a waste of time. And I know that carbon sequestration science is something that you're really interested in. So do you have any comments as to where we're actually at with these technologies at the moment?
Yes, unfortunately, we're very the research on this aspect has been not a priority in the past, and because of reservations from both the public and also the research community, that even the research on that topic would be a moral hazard, that kind of distracts from the actual important thing, which is reducing emissions. This research is just in its infancy. So we are unfortunately not very far with it. So it's not like we can go out and employ some kind of technology. The technology doesn't exist yet. So we actually trying to understand what we can do to sequester additional carbon. But there's few technology that works. The one you were referring to, carbon capture and storage, is something different than what I'm referring to when I talk about negative emissions, because carbon capture and storage is essentially an engineered process where we strip carbon dioxide, for example, from coal power plants. So, you know, an enriched gas flue, just we strip that and pump it underground. And that is far more advanced with respect to research than what I'm referring to when I talk about negative emissions, which is the removal of legacy emissions from the atmosphere. So just, you know, from the removal of CO2 from the air around you. So carbon capture and storage and negative emissions are slightly different things, but both are essential to, to reach climate targets. So both are, like the IPCC formulated it recently, unavoidable.
And you mentioned briefly legacy. You know, what we emit today, we're only going to see years down the line, especially the effects of. What's your, bit of an obvious question this, but what's your thoughts on, can we actually reduce those emissions that we need to by the end of this decade? You know, in terms of where the level is at, our emissions, is it actually possible to drastically reduce the levels so that it's actually more manageable? Is that actually even worth holding out hope for?
I'm optimistic in general. I'm also realistic. So currently emissions are still increasing, right? So we're supposed to be on a declining path since many years already, but it keeps on increasing. So the reality says no. The reality says it's unlikely to be achievable. But then there was a recent study came out, and I think just last week or so, in Nature, saying that if policy or decision makers stick to what they committed to with their pledges to the Paris Agreement, then there's a high chance that warming can be limited to 2 degrees. Or somewhere between 1.5 and 2 degrees. And if politicians actually do what they promise, then there is some chance to get this somewhat under control. But
Very optimistic there. Very optimistic. Well, holding up for politicians.
I mean, there's also strong interest in achieving this, right? I mean, politicians will also recognize that there are serious problems associated with it and serious costs. I mean, climate change, to be honest, I don't think it's a science problem anymore. I think it's a political problem.
100%. Okay, so from a realism point of view, reducing emissions, it's not going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen next year. It's a work in progress that needs to see more urgency from our leaders, from our leaders at the top, policies, and so on. So putting that aside, you've touched on already the need to not just reduce, but also somehow manage and capture and so on. So let's look at ocean-based solutions. It's another area of expertise of yours. And there's quite a few, terms that I've come across, preparing for this that I've never heard of. So can you talk to us about a few of them? Like, what is artificial upwelling? Never heard of that concept, but sounds fascinating.
Yeah, so artificial upwelling is the idea. So all of the things you talking about now is ideas to use the ocean to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, right?
Yeah.
And artificial upwelling is one of those ideas. So the idea here is to pump water from the deep ocean into the surface ocean through pipes. And the reason for this is that the deep ocean is very rich in nutrients, which photosynthesizing phytoplankton need in order to grow and to fix carbon, right? So it's basically a fertilization strategy with deep ocean water, because the surface ocean is largely limited in nutrients. In the oceans, nutrient is what the equivalent of water would be on land, right? So as soon as you have water on land, some plants will grow. And in the ocean, it's mostly nutrients. As soon as you have nutrients in the ocean, in the surface ocean, where there's sun, some phytoplankton will grow. So the idea here is to get those nutrients from the deep, because there's lots of nutrients, and therefore stimulate photosynthetic carbon fixation in the surface.
So are you basically trying to almost speed up thermohaline circulation, or are you wanting to concentrate it, in one place?
So probably you this concept would probably be applied in ocean regions that are really low in nutrients, right? So in subtropical regions, where they're due to physical reasons that are quite complicated, there is little nutrients in the surface ocean. So you would probably pump it up there, because there you have lots of light, and the nutrients could actually be utilized. You wouldn't do it in Antarctica in winter, right? Because there's no light for this to work. But in the subtropics, it could work. Or at least, let's say, it could work to the extent that there would be primary production following the upwelling. That's very likely. I don't really believe in this strategy for other reasons, which I think, I don't know if it's, if we should dive into that, because it's getting very complicated very fast. But let's start with the simplest reason why artificial upwelling is problematic. The deep ocean is rich in nutrients, but it's also rich in CO2, because all of the biomass that is sinking.
I was going to ask that. Do we not risk bringing it all back up?
Yeah, so you basically pump up also CO2. And then what would need to happen is you probably would need to fix more carbon than you upweld alongside the nutrients, right? And because plankton ecosystems are so complicated, I wouldn't dare to predict if that works out. It's really hard to predict that. So it's a biological strategy to sequester, or idea to sequester carbon. And biology is always so complicated that trying to predict it and work with it, it's not something I would personally do.
I think that's a good enough reason. I mean, here we are, human intervention has caused this problem, and now human intervention is trying to fix a problem by creating another problem. That's the simplistic view that I'm seeing.
It's like the cane toads with the cane beetles, potentially.
Yeah. Well, that's the narrative against basically all climate intervention strategies. I think it does apply to some extent to all of them, but to a very variable degree, right? So there's I think approaches that are more promising than others, at least based on the research I've done so far.
Okay. What about the next one then? So ocean iron fertilization. What's the process here?
Just sounds like another mess again.
So iron fertilization that is in principle builds upon the same thing, so that phytoplankton in the surface ocean is limited by nutrients. In the case of iron fertilization, you utilize the fact that much of the surface ocean is not nutrient limited in general, but iron limited specifically. So there are nutrients, but one is missing, and that is iron. But if you add iron, then they have everything they need to grow, and then they do that. And that actually has been tested very thoroughly. So we know very well that this this works to the extent that we can stimulate primary production. So that has been, there's been ships going out and actually adding lots of iron to the ocean. And because iron is a trace nutrient, so you need very, very little amounts to stimulate productivity. It's actually possible to do this with just 3 tons of iron substrate. You can add this, for example, into the Southern Ocean. And then you see a phytoplankton bloom even from space. So you can see this with satellites. And so that's the scale at which this is actually possible. The problem there is that we've never been able to really verify that the carbon that has been fixed is actually stored for long term in the ocean, right? So we're not really getting there with the research we've done so far. And there's good reasons to believe that it may not really work in many places.
Would you end up potentially with dead zones by doing that though? Like if there's a huge plankton bloom and then inevitably that runs its course, so it'll sink. Like can the ocean become hypoxic where you're doing that?
So what you're referring to is that when you produce photosynthetically carbon, so you produce biomass, and that biomass then it eventually sinks into the deep ocean, oxygen is consumed because the biomass gets respired by bacteria and all sorts of microbes, and that they consume oxygen. And therefore, if you add more organic biomass to the ocean, then more oxygen is consumed. And then it depends. So whether or not it could be a dead zone depends on how much you apply it, right? So there's quite a lot of oxygen in the ocean. So you would have to kind of push it really hard to get to a level where you have anoxia. But I mean, some organisms, it may decrease to a certain level where some organisms think, oh, nope, that's not enough oxygen for me. I'll avoid this. For example, like tuna or some, like organisms with high oxygen demands because they are fast swimmers or something like that. So that may happen first. I doubt that we could push it to the extent that we have like ocean dead zones that expand globally. But in theory, yes. In theory, that could happen if you push it too hard.
Well, considering how many ocean dead zones we have globally, again, it goes back to your earlier point. Is it a risk we're willing to take with another, excuse the pun, deadly outcome? Because I was thinking earlier, maybe shipwrecks aren't a bad thing for the oceans. You know, you've got a whole bunch of iron sitting there and interacting with the environment.
Well, they're usually at the ocean bottom where there's not so much life.
True. So we need them on the shorelines. Now, ocean afforestation, that to me sounds a little promising. Is that along the same lines of reforesting land, you know, planting trees, planting plants that are going to capture carbon? Explain to us the concept of afforestation, but in the oceans.
Can I ask you a question before I start there?
Oh, dear.
Why do you think that sounds promising?
Because on the face of it, we're using, I mean, actually, now that I'm thinking about the conversation we've had, everything sounds promising. Yeah, I'm starting to back down because also increasing too much of one thing is can have a negative impact in other areas.
Let me guess why you had the gut feeling that this is promising, because of the term afforestation, perhaps?
Potentially.
Because afforestation is associated with something nice.
on land, that is. True.
The concept is basically grow kelp or other types of seaweed in the open ocean where they not naturally occur. There are some exceptions of species that occur in the open ocean, but not the benthic seaweed. So the seaweeds that grow at the bottom of the ocean that we know, they don't grow in the open ocean because they don't have substrate to attach to. But the idea of ocean afforestation is to provide such substrate in the form of, you know, long lines or platforms or some other sort of substrate, and then they grow in that. And when they grow, they obviously fix carbon because they are photosynthesizing organisms, and that then would fix carbon and lead to carbon sequestration, as long as the biomass that's bound within the kelp is not respired and released back into the atmosphere. So that's the basic idea behind it.
So which one do you think is most promising at this point in time?
Well, personally, I think the most promising one is one we haven't talked about yet, which is the key focus of the research I'm doing right now, which is alkalinity enhancement. And the reason why this is not so well known is because it's complicated, and the term alkalinity usually has no meaning to anyone apart from some experts. But so here the idea is to kind of accelerate the natural geological cycle. How do I start? Certain types of rocks, right? Just rocks that are lying around, they absorb carbon when they dissolve. So rocks, they dissolve, or what we call chemical weathering of rocks, but obviously very slowly, right? We can't see this on our lifetimes. We see a rock somewhere and it looks the same for all of our lifetime. But if you look at that rock in 100,000 years, it looks different because it weathers. And the idea of ocean alkalinity enhancement is to use this process. So you use the rocks to accelerate their weathering rates. And that would, for example, be possible by, taking that rock, grinding it to powder and distributing it all over land, because the powder obviously has much higher surface area than the single rock. And therefore, it would dissolve much faster. And during the dissolution of this rock, there is a chemical component that is created, and that is called alkalinity. And that's the name-giving feature of why we call it ocean alkalinity enhancement. So if we do, the rock dissolution in the oceans, that would increase ocean alkalinity. And ocean alkalinity basically describes the capacity of seawater to absorb inorganic carbon. It has nothing to do with biology. And that's, by the way, the reason why I'm kind of leaning towards it at the moment, is because it doesn't involve biology. Whenever you involve biology, you add an additional layer of complexity, right? We already have to deal with physics, chemistry, and the less biology comes in, the better, right? Because biology is so freaking complicated. So so obviously doing this would have implications for biology, because the alkalinity is a chemical compound, so it does affect biology to some extent, but it's an inadvertent effect, so it's not something we intend to do. We just have to make sure that the side effects from this are not overly negative. And that's why I'm kind of leaning towards this approach more than towards the others, because I don't think the others can deliver at any scale that is needed.
And on your website, you actually mention a bit of a citizen science project that people can take part in if they're based in Tasmania. So tell us about that. How can people get involved there?
That project is about mapping this chemical quantity I was talking about. So alkalinity, mapping alkalinity in Tasmania. So what's happening on land is that weathering occurs, and we can measure some of the signal of weathering, of natural weathering in rivers, because they kind of transport the water into the oceans, and they go over the rocks, and therefore they kind of leach out the alkalinity. And then the idea was, it was a bit naive, to be honest. So I thought, okay, we'll map it out. And for in the case we start doing this, we increase the weathering rains by distributing this rock all over the place. We have a baseline for the time before this started, right? So this was kind of my original intention. Now having started this, and I gathered significant amounts of data, showed me that the variability is so huge that we probably won't get a baseline that is reliable, because, you know, the baseline will be a certain value plus minus a very large value. So we probably won't be able to use this as a baseline to say, okay, now we increased the dispersal of minerals artificially, and therefore we have a higher value all of a sudden, because the signal will be small initially, and I don't think we'll be able to detect it. But it's nevertheless a very useful exercise to do, and I think the data will be exciting and valuable for the scientific record. It's just a steep learning curve, because obviously I'm an oceanographer, and going on land was a novelty for me, and it was very interesting, and it brings you to all these lovely places, right? So that was another incentive for me to, you know, to go all over the place and find small creeks and rivers and sample them.
And has there been much support or contribution from the general public with this?
Mostly the people I talk to. So it's not like I can, you know, some very people I don't really know would reach out. And that happened initially when I advertised it a lot. Then I became a bit lazy on it. It's mostly people in my surrounding that bring samples in. But I'd be happy to have many more people involved. I thought it was a great way to kind of convey the concept of alkalinity to a wider public, because it's contact point, right? So we're actually measuring something together, and I have feedback on what the value would be in the river the people live close to, right? So there's some link to this very complicated concept of alkalinity. I mean, even in my favorite chemistry book, the introductory sentence in this book about alkalinity is that some famous chemical oceanographer has said that this concept is perhaps one of the most important but least well understood in chemical oceanography. So it's very complicated, and that's why it's not sounding as a promising approach to many. So that maybe that, you know, ocean afforestation is easy to explain to everyone. So yeah, that's why it's very popular. But but if you go deep down the biogeochemical rabbit hole, you will notice that there's very little potential of this approach, most likely.
Well, we certainly have some listeners in Tasmania. We know that. So who knows, you might get a couple of contributions from that. So we always like to end a session, I'm going to call it today, on a positive note. And you've certainly shown a lot of that through your, you know, a lot of your explanations. I mean, this could have been a very much an episode on this isn't going to work, this isn't going to work, there's no solutions. You're very hopeful in that. But for the general public, you know, our listeners, is there anything we can do to contribute to this very complex world? I mean, we've spoken a lot about chemical reactions and nature and so on, but is there anything we can contribute to helping the oceans be more efficient, other than stop littering and stop putting rubbish into the, watching what we put down the drains and so on? But is there anything else we can actually do?
Well, probably the most important thing you can do is influence systemic change through voting. I was intrigued by it. There was an interesting comment by a climate scientist called Michael Mann, and he made the case that much like there's a very sinister deflection strategy by a fossil fuel lobbyist saying that we all put it on the individual now, because then obviously nothing will happen, right? So if I tell you what to do, you say, oh, I don't know, we just accuse ourselves. But the actual thing is asking for probably for systemic change. So like trying to lobby for the implementation of renewables, that is the most important thing, and actually way more important than any of the stuff I was talking about. You know, carbon sequestration is getting down the emissions. That is the cheapest, most important thing to do. And an individual action needs to come on top of that. But I think the more important one is the systemic change and the way we should lobby for it collectively.
Yeah, so going to the root of the problem rather than, you know, we always use, usually in a health context here, but the analogy of turning the tap off at the wall rather than mopping up the water that's running on the floor.
Yeah, that's a good analogy for mitigation or reduction of emissions versus carbon sequestration, right? Carbon sequestration is needed and useful for the remaining bits of carbon emissions that won't be avoidable. So, you know, agricultural emissions, the really hard to decarbonize sectors, for that we're going to need, carbon sequestration methods. We shouldn't think of it as a replacement of, you know, shutting down fossil fuel consumption through coal combustion and these kind of things. It's not a replacement for that.
Yeah. Or basically, in other words, used as a cop-out for companies that are not bringing about change. So, Leonard, this has been fantastic. I feel like this has been a myth-busting conversation or lesson for us, because, you know, I fell into the trap of, oh, afforestation sounds great. Is there an organization that runs it? I'll donate some money every month and we'll solve the world's problems. You know, it's very easy to be, I'll use the word misled, but you've brought a lot of very important understanding to a lot of these concepts that are bandied around, and maybe not a lot now, probably be picked up by some politicians or some companies say, we've got a solution. This is what it is. That's the path we're going to go, whilst not actually making the most important change. And that is reducing our reliance on fossil fuels. That's really what it comes down to, as well as systemic behavioral change. We really want to thank you so much for your valuable time. You do an incredible amount of research and work and education. You know, we've watched some of your online webinars and lectures and so on. And we encourage our listeners to visit Leonard's website and educate and just be better informed, so that if we need to place a vote for a politician or donate some money to an actual cause that can actually make a real valuable change, we're a little bit better educated. And that's what these podcasts are about. Leonard, thank you so much again for your contribution, your experience, your wisdom, and your hope. That's the most important.
Well, thanks so much for your time as well. And it was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. If you found this interesting, make sure you subscribe and share it with your friends.